In the next hour, we are going to talk about the importance of community for people we call sick, disabled, deviant, and about their importance for us. Communalizing labeled people. Now, in taking up a question like this, we really are taking on the modern world. Because in the last generation, since the 60s, the number of people we label as in need of some very special kind of help has doubled or tripled in almost every field you can name, and so have the expenditures, the societal expenditures for that kind of enterprise, if that's a word. Mental health, education, juvenile justice, criminal justice, family services, all have experienced a rise, two or threefold in percent of GNP, and a rise in the number of clients or patients or designated persons, we're calling labeled persons at the outset of this evening, similarly, twofold or threefold. The question arises, have we got the question right? Georges Bernanos has a wonderful sentence in his Diary of a Country Priest. He says, the worst, the most corrupting of lies is a problem poorly stated. Well, we have to see whether we've got this one rightly stated, and I guess that would be a good enough task for this hour. Now, Walter Altman this morning helped us by giving us a little scheme of approaches communities can take to problems. Seeing, judging, acting, not necessarily in that order. You can start anywhere and move in any direction, and in fact, you're likely to move back and forth. And I suggest we go at this problem this way. We'll all know where we are, and we'll all be able to tag what didn't get said or what we could contribute, and then we can find things. Find things we weren't thinking before. Cicero has a little scheme like this in a textbook he did for citizens. I only mention it because Augustine used them left and right, and Augustine said it's all right for Christians to use these pagan clarified arts because they make a lot of sense and they really come from God. It saved him a lot of footnotes. it's kind of a humane way into a question, and I suggest that after we've said initially what we see on this problem and then go into the judging aspect, and there use, as we've been saying, a kind of biblical and church historical tradition, we'll want to go back and see some more things. So it'll be a little back and forth, but we don't want to stop until we've talked a little bit about what to do, right? So then, what do we see about labeled people these days that might seem problematic? Well, we've already said some easy things. The steep incline of expenditures with respect to, quote, labeled people in our society. The equal incline of people needing that kind of help. We're not gaining on the problem. Something seems to be amiss. What's more, some of these systems seem able to absorb just about any amount of money you can throw at them, and we're not sure that you would gain on the number of clients. Certainly in the health system, that's been the case. We have the highest health expenditures in the world, and 30 million people, without regular access. That's one of the things we look at. What else might we look at to see whether there's a problem? Or that looks a little bit disturbing. We're going to say a little later what the problem is when we get to the judging phase. All right? How about the fact that the big problems, the big labeled people in our society these days, the big killers, are not being addressed directly by any institution? By this I mean infant mortality. I mean, there are little efforts, but not to meet the need. Alcohol, drugs, AIDS. The big problems that are almost like plague-like in the society and that have us all on the edge of our chairs, these aren't being addressed very directly by any of the increasingly expensive systems we've talked about. Those are some of the things we might remember. And a question arises, what kind of judgment is called for? Now, let's keep this question in our mind. We'll want to return to it. What do we see? But let's let that be enough to turn to the judging question, in which I propose we think of ourselves as a congregation or a community. Let's make it a congregation and begin using our own sources by which to look at this now undefined problem we have pointed at. Remember, we've said before, and Fern has told us this, and we're hearing it again and again, that we read an ancient text, or a biblical text, one of our texts, partly to improve our eyesight in the present. We understand a text when we can begin to say what that text might say in a situation it did not itself address. Then you've got its works. Now, what would happen if we threw that kind of lens on this problem and started to form judgments? That's our next exercise, all right? And you should all be kind of doing it and chime in when you wish. All right. Let's begin with Scripture. Let's say one or two preliminary words about using the Scripture. We've heard again and again in this week, certainly I have, that one of the notes that Christian communities throughout the world are striking is that we ought to begin with the poor. We've heard lots of reasons for that, but one is that it increases perception. You might see some things you didn't see before, and it also points to a future in which they're incorporated rather than left out. That puts us in the sort of bind that moves our inquiry along. That kind of note has come from Jewish, Catholic, Orthodox, and Protestant biblical scholars in our day. From the third world has come an insistence on contextualism. If I understand it right, they want us to remember that even when we read the Scriptures, and even when we know they're going to judge us and say some surprising things to us, we still come to them with a mindset gathered out of the air we breathe. That what you see depends a little bit on where you sit or where you stand. And you'd better know it. That note has been struck by biblical scholars in our day, and I think especially by the third world. Let's remember that too. And finally, I think especially in biblical theology since World War II, there's been attention even to the principalities and powers. By that, we mean that not only is there a kind of contextualism, but that contextualism can start to roll sometimes. It can start to gather into big balls and roll over us. We ought to be attentive to the way in which a mindset develops in an age that really starts to carry us somewhere. At least that's what the biblical theologians are telling us, and they say that that's what the Bible warns us about. So that if you get a kind of corporate rolling toward racism or sexism or consumerism or monetarism or hedonism, whatever, that can happen. I'm not now making a judgment. I'm saying when we read, we should realize that kind of thing, or medicalism, could be part of our mentality. If we just allow ourselves to think about this brush in front of letting the Scriptures talk to us, it might help a bit. And here I have to make a confession I should have made sooner, that most of what I'm prepared to say tonight, having spent some time with the Scripture and church history on this topic, is not something I believe, or not something that comes natural to me. I just have to tell you, I owe it, to be sure, to these strange, wild texts that always fire a shot across my bow, and I also owe it to some people in Chicago who are working hard along these lines. Jody Kretzman among them. So I have to say that. In St. John of the Ladder, the writer takes up the question whether, when the teachers and preachers say stuff they don't themselves believe, should we shut them up or not? And he says, no, let them continue to talk. One of these days, they'll hear themselves and start to believe. That, I think, is Lutheran Confessions as well. Now then, let's begin our kind of reflection in order to get our own, start forming our judgment about this kind of undifferentiated problem of labeled people in our society. They're growing, and in spite of massive efforts,
We don't seem to be gaining on the problem. If we look in the scripture, this is kind of a little recitation of my approach to this problem during the last hour. If we look in the scripture for things that look something like prescriptions for this problem, do this, we won't get very far, I think, with our labeled people. There in Leviticus, there is something about if you have an itch under your beard, what you should do, you should go through some motions, you should go to a priest. And it's all interesting, but I don't think it has, maybe some New Age people could find something in there. But it doesn't have a great, it is tied to a kind of context, including a ritual and social context that makes it not easily, it doesn't open my eyes to a lot. Or leprosy. I know we like to use leprosy texts with AIDS, and there might be something there, but to go and dip seven times in the Ganges, it's pretty hard to bring over. That approach may not get us very far. And some people, when they get to this point, say, well, and they slide all the way over and say, what really matters is love. The physician should love his patient. You should know that God is loving you through the physician. That's about it. Some people think situation ethics did that. I do not think so. But I do think that faith has a great deal more spine and content to it than that. So let's keep looking. On almost every page in the scripture, or throughout the scripture certainly, problems of suffering, of pain, of deviation, and death are writ large. These are very important and significant for the writers of the scriptures and presumably for their readers. And it's given almost as a matter of faith that you have to, that dealing with these activates and clarifies your faith. You're supposed to sort this out. And if you look at the scriptures, a whole lot of different kind of causes are given. For example, one cause is sin. Psalm 32, when I kept silence, my bones waxed old through my roaring all the day long. And this could apply to whole groups that kept silent for too long and whose bones are waxing old. That's always a possibility for some kind of malfunction or non-function. Sometimes the cause is listed as foolishness. Psalm 38. My wounds festered for my foolishness. And sometimes the reason is given as a suffering for righteousness' sake. Those who remember the prophets and the martyrs, those who try to live in the world in obedience to Christ, remember how we did 1 Peter the other day? Should not be surprised if suffering does not go out of the way for them. That's a possibility. And some suffering is for no reason at all, except that we live in an imperfect world, or we live between the times. And when we face suffering in that situation, we may actually find ourselves, says St. Paul, groaning with the creation, looking forward to another kind or state of affairs, which is in the intention of God and in the power of Christ to bring. And, you know, when we sigh in that kind of suffering for no reason at all, except that's the way it is, we know ourselves as fellow heirs with Christ of the city that is to come. Now, that's a whole lot of things. And at least in one passage in James, the suggestion is, when you're sick, if anybody's sick, let him call the elders or somebody and start sorting this out. The point I like to make is a simpler one and a kind of negative one. When that happens, for the sake of yourself or your faith, you may not simply accept a patient role. Now, I know that's what's sold by some. If you accept a patient role at the point, you've lost it. That's why some theologians write books called The Patient as Person or The Patient as Agent these days. Well, I think we'd affirm that. That is clearly the case. And therefore, kind of first mining I get looking at our common scriptural heritage in order to improve my eyesight with respect to a kind of massive health problem in our society is that these things are significant for faith and may not be made insignificant by hiving them off to somebody else. That's a first thing that we'd have to say, and that would have some implications for how we go about these things. We're not saying that there's no role for medics in, let us say, ameliorating needless suffering, or let us say, in staving off needless death. But we haven't said a lot when we've said that. It must be very difficult to be a physician these days. Ivy McKenzie, one of the commentator on medical things, says that the physician doesn't deal with a species. He's not a scientist, really. He deals with an individual. It's more like an art. And what he's trying to do is to help this individual come through a sticky patch of life, preserving his or her identity. Aha, but what is that identity? Now, for lack of any knowledge or agreement about that, all the physician can do is reduce all the pain he can and extend all the life he can. But then all the quandaries there are arise. What happens when you extend life at the cause of, or you diminish pain at the cause of shortening life, or you extend life at the cause of terrible and debilitating pain? And how do you answer that question? Is that part of a medical practice? How do we go after something like that? How can this be decided except on the basis of some understanding of what you're living for? I remember a New Testament teacher at the Divinity School of the University of Chicago, Norman Perrin, who was given a choice between 3 good years or 12 dug ones. We got 2 extra books out of him because he picked 3 years. And he said, at one point he defined health. He said, health is the ability to function in pleasure and in pain, and the ability to enjoy success and risk failure. Which means there's sort of a healthy way to be sick, which we hadn't thought about before. That is important for faith. And we're not, uttering great truths here, but we are indicating that we may be pointing to a problem in the way we are dealing with labeled people that cuts them out of, or cuts us out of, the importance of faith in those situations. Right to die is an important thing to I don't want to go that far. Right to decide is an important thing, no doubt. Informed consent, important, no doubt. But there is yet another question for all of us, and that is a matter of deciding what's right. How do you do that? You leave that to the minister and the ethicist and the physician standing at the foot of the bed. Can these ever replace a surrounding community that has teaching and support in these matters? Are we not seeing a kind of indissoluble connection between suffering and death in human life and community? Kind of specially shaped with respect to church. Well, those are the ways I'm going at this question of judgment. So that the first thing I pretend now, and you may question me, to get out of our scriptural tradition is that the locus of health is community. Now, if you want to talk about this individual body, which is a pretty modern construct, I'm told. Ivan Illich says, our notion of health is attaching to just this organism. Sort of goes back to William Harvey's blood circulation. And this. Most meanings of health before that have to do with function and do intake. Whitehead would have said that's a case of misplaced concreteness if you don't realize you're also constituted by your relationships, and that's part of the picture. But even if you just talk about this, this organism, we ought to at least pay respects in passing to the fact that that too is a community, right? And there's nothing wrong with a cancer cell in itself. It's just, it's not behaving very well in the neighborhood. It's, John Updike, you know his little book of poems called Facing Nature, struggled all his life with psoriasis. Described at length one time in the New Yorker. He has a little poem which he says, a scab is a beautiful thing, a coin that the body has minted, bearing the invisible motto, "In God We Trust." So, for scab. I mean, that is to say, even at this level, I mean, you're dealing with community. That's the only point we're making now. But we want to quickly go on to talk about a larger community that's involved. All right. Let's pause to pick up a bit of Bible
that does implicate in ways we don't always see because of contextualism, implicate the community. I once heard Walter Brueggemann preach on blind Bartimaeus, Mark 10, 6 verses that long. It's a short little thing. But he did, you'd expect. If this is a healing miracle, which isn't irrelevant, what do we get out of these? Here are some of the things he said. Maybe you can all remember that text. Let's see if we can do it without reading it. Blind Bartimaeus, he's a blind beggar in the street. Jesus is walking past. He says, "All you know, you can miss this unless you remember that these words are inspired. you really have to start looking. Your first question is he begging because he's blind? Is he poor because he's blind? Not all blind people are poor. Or is he blind because he's poor? Nutrition, external definitions. It's a wonderful book on the making of a blind man that we can talk about a little later. Let's stay with Bartimaeus. You ask that question to start with. Then starts the story. You should not forget the third. Fern would have told us this. You should not forget the third character in this story, not just Jesus and Bartimaeus, but the many. What the many do is tell Bartimaeus to shut up and sit down. Be quiet. Beggars cannot be choosers or something like that. Shut up and sit down. That's a third. In some of the Gospels, that's those are designated as the chief priests and scribes. Here's the many. But Bartimaeus cries out all the more, "Son of David, i.e. Messiah, have mercy on me." He is fixing his cry out of his depths, we talked about that, on the Messiah, or the Messianic age in which the picture is one of everybody functions, right? We celebrate that in the offertory, everybody brings their gifts. The Messianic age. He's attaching himself to Jesus, and he says he believes to the Messianic age. Jesus utters one very small sentence, "Your faith has made you whole." Now, if Jesus had taken some yucca plants and broken up them and put them in his eyes, then probably not much would be revealed, and the story probably would never have been written, or if it had been written, it would have been forgotten. He uttered the word. "Your faith has made you whole." And the next thing we hear is that Bartimaeus is following him along the way. What did Brueggemann get out of this? Five things. Listen. One. Disease reflects powerlessness in the community. See that context for this blind man. The way he was being treated, it reflects powerlessness in the community. Second, general opinion serves to perpetuate this powerlessness. Contextualism we talked about, denying the man his voice. Three, the man nonetheless cries out, without which nothing. No Exodus, no Gethsemane. No Reformation. He cries out anyway. The cry is important. We all know how that theme works in this theology. Fourth, Jesus, the Messiah, is the healing principle transforming the beggar's life. Other healings, sticking something down his throat or into his arm or up him, or jogging for that matter, doesn't accomplish this kind of healing. And finally, this healing extends to the transformation of community itself as well, for now we have the formerly excluded and functionless present and participating. That's pretty good for 6 verses. And now I suppose we could miss that because in our own setting, by and large, we would hospitalize this blind man. I mean, there's a whole army of services just waiting for him. So we tend to maybe get this. I remember once walking down the street with Ivan Illich, I'm going to mention in a minute, and he's in a third world country, he had so many beggars, and he was begging for a coin, and Ivan gave him a coin, and the beggar said, "God bless you," and Ivan said, "You have given me 1,000 times what I have given you." Their presence was there, and that was important for him. That, I think they're kind of off the streets. For us, a little bit off the streets. That may be
a little bit hard, make it harder for us to appropriate this text. But what I really wanted to mention was a speech that Ilitch gave in Chicago. He's the one that wrote the book on medical nemesis. Last fall, called The History of Hospitality. Now, you have to know that when he's saying hospitality, he's got a little hospital in there. And he does the ancient Greeks, the ancient Hebrews, and the first Christians. And he shows that all of these were required to see and express solidarity with the needy, whatever their label, homeless, hungry, sojourner, pilgrim, whatever it was. The Greek had to do this out of deference to Zeus. There was even a ritual about cutting the lamb's throat at the threshold and bringing them both over. Oh, if you didn't do that, you were in real trouble. The Jew had to do it because he too was a stranger and sojourner, and the Christian, above all on the road, has, you know, the Good Samaritan to think about. Just take him in your arms, you ain't got too much else, but that you do. I mean, too much else of your own. So that he gave this picture, and he says, through all this period, you could march across Europe just staying with folks who were bound to take you in and treat you in this deference. Sometimes, I think the Muslims had to keep you 3 days until you started hearing the word of God. But they could, it was a reverential thing to take of it. Not until Constantine did you get the first poorhouses, flop houses, and Ilitch said, this is what struck me, that was the beginning of the poor as a class. And Jonathan Kozol sort of says that in his new book on New York shelters, Rachel and Her Children. And William Julius Wilson has data on the modern city, 50 modern cities, showing what the kind of woesome effects of massifying and separating the needy, the labeled people in the society. Well, we're seeing something, are we not, as a result of our poor old blind Bartimaeus has opened our eyes to some things we didn't mention when we first started talking about this sort of massified health problem in our society. Right? Let's go on then to talk about what to do on the basis of what we're now seeing. And we can drop back to what's to be seen and what judgments need making. But let's just move along so we can kind of do the race course and then we can rerun it. Discourse, by the way, really means running around in this way. Every one of these, what you see, what you judge, how you judge, what to do, is a subject for discussion. Now, I know discussion is a very dull word for us, but the Latin is discutere. It means to shake things up and find a new problem. So it's a device, and let's keep open all these lines, these connected lines, but let's go on now to the question of what to do. You know, I'm feeling like blind Bartimaeus. This is literally the first time in my life I've put these on in public. Mm-hmm. Are you ready to comfort me? This is terrible. Anybody got a yucca plant? No, well, see, so we know our mortality, and we want to come back to that. What should a community do? Well, now let's start looking at what they're able to do, even with respect to lots of our labeled diseases. Families have had tested over centuries, ways of dealing with food, with stress, with sex, with disputes, with the functionless, without which wisdom it's hard to think of anybody being healthy for very long. Exactly that has been kind of shaken out of us, I think. At least we're trying to find a new something that might have to be reconstituted. At least we should realize that. Congregations, I suppose, have that too, and it differs a little bit from community to community. In Chicago, somebody mentioned last night, the Mexicans have the lowest infant mortality rate in the city. Puerto Ricans the highest. Why? There's got to be some kind of family stuff still functioning there. But it's distended and weakened, not only in our civic communities, but in our congregations. Somebody said here the other day, we all come from everywhere else. All we can pray for is peace and somebody's chemotherapy. We're not doing anything together. Granger Westberg, I don't know if he's kidding, but he spoke about churches that are now deciding to bury their members face down in the casket because that's the part of it everybody recognizes, the back of his head. That's what he said. I'm very fortunate these days to work with a development project you all know about, I think, in Guatemala, works with the Kaqchikel Indians. And once in a while, the director of this program and some others come to Chicago to visit us. Carol Bearhorst, I think he was on his way here this summer, but really had to go back to Guatemala. He'll come sometime. Sometimes when they come, we sit them down with people on the west side who have been working on questions of health. And they will say, in our highlands, when we are sick, we first talk to our grandmother, and then we talk to our neighbors, and then we talk to our druggist. And for a certain number of things, we go to the local doctor, and for some, we start the long hike to a hospital. People on the west side say, we used to do that a little more when we just came from Mississippi. Since we got our green cards, we don't do that no more. Go to no druggist, don't know where we go. We line up at the clinic until we can, well, I don't know. Something has disappeared. That's all, my only point. That has functioned in the past and somehow has to function. I don't want to overstate this because my goodness, we see every day all kinds of helpful wisdom coming out here, but maybe that needs to be focused and cultivated the way you are doing it. Secondly, big killers in the city. Those have really raised terror in the citizenry. Infant mortality, drugs, single parents, AIDS. Can you, in your wildest imagination, imagine those being addressed except by a community? Or you can pick up some of the casualties, although we're not doing good on that either. Can you imagine? I mean, the big killers, the ones that we talk about our great gains in morbidity and mortality, the fact is that until the 1960s, we never spent more than 4.5% of our GNP on health. And that's when the big gains were made, usually through engineering and inoculation. Now we spend more than 10%. $1 out of every $9 goes to the health system. Nobody's voting or sending it in. I mean, you know, sending like the Golden Vision Fund. It's a big vacuum cleaner out there. It's kind of everybody's salary kicks in. Everybody who has a salary. It just kind of just comes in functioning. Like that, but our point at the moment is it's not able to address the what really bothers us now in terms of some of the big worries. There are other worries, and what affects any individual is a big worry for him or her. But I mean the numerical worries in the society. The young, especially, are not being addressed by that very expensive system. Third, while we're now inspecting what communities could do. Think about going after the conditions of incapacity or the conditions of capacity. Who is best able to do that? And here we have a near canonic story in Chicago. Some of Jody's colleagues went to work with community in Garfield Park, and it was kind of a detective function. Find out what's causing our people to get sick. They went to all the emergency clinics and went through all the admissions to see what was doing it. It wasn't easy because you'd read a broken tibia, but they didn't tell you how he got it. But you'd like to know that. They did the best they could, and when they were finished, they found 7 major causes. Let me say, see if I can sing them off. Automobile accidents. Violence, especially at home, beating each other up on Saturday night. Other kinds of accidents. A kind of bronchitis traceable to diet, obesity, dog bites, and this one. Any of those going to be solved through the current health systems that were... And these people, when they started going after some of these, they found out where cars were hitting people, worked on the folks that had the parking lot there, they rounded up dogs, gave $5 a head. They began to think, I mean, shouldn't some of that health money be coming from this? I mean, for a healthy activity. Well, that's what they said. So that's the third thing, the ability of communities to go after the causes and conditions of ill health. Anything else that I think of? Oh, and the worst of all causes, at least in our cities, I don't know if it's true all over the world, is poverty itself.
it's demonstrated that a certain amount of good can be done for the illness of poor people, but there comes a point where you can't. When in one sense, the only cure for the disease caused by poverty is income. We have, there's now been studies in all the major industrial nations linking liver and heart and pulmonary disease to unemployment. I'm not now making a case for a certain kind of society, but that linkage is demonstrated. And the great woesome circumstance is that exactly those when the biggest needs are, biggest sudden needs are, become, lose access to the health system if they lose what is our great open sesame, namely insurance. All right, so we have not only seen the importance of community for health and politics and participation, but we have also turned it around and looked at how communities can go to work on the conditions of health. And if we wished, we could, I think, start singing off some other things, and I hope you'll do that with me. Let's begin. In fact, I've heard stories around here today and yesterday. A lot of you are full of things to say on this one. But certainly, in dealing, say, with our own congregational community, the first healthy thing to do would be to examine it for its capacities, not for its needs. How many of you run need surveys? Jody and his friends have capacity surveys. Healthier. They see the glass is half full, not half empty. And work with that. Then at least you've got health going. Something like that, say. Infants to be, probably something to be done. Disabled, as we say disabled because it's the way we're architecturally constructed, it works for us but not for them so well. This morning, Fern talked about the hearing, remember? And very simple to do ramps and so on. But at least to make the disabled participants, and not just able to get in, but able to function, and to have offices, and that looks like a healthy activity alongside of all the rest we've been talking about. And then even on particular diseases, epilepsy, somebody up in Evanston, I heard say lately, epileptic is somebody with a problem 10 minutes a day. Can you make any kind of arrangement? It's kind of communal, and you've got another functioning person. All right, not a drain. Or AIDS. Oh, my. Housing. I mean, even if we don't go into the metaphysics of this, transition, long way. You got any hunch that's going to be resolved without the attention of parishes or communities? And without some kind of communal organization for it, in spite of our disposition to think other ways? The Christians who are professionals, you don't think that out of this kind of seeing and judging would come a reshaping of what they do? Some people are doing it, learning to join and become a friend of the person who should now move to functioning again in the community. Or research of all sorts could be done along this line. It isn't done necessarily by a service association. So along those lines, we can start thinking of what to do. And then when it comes to public provisions for health, we have to look to larger coalitions, as on some of these other things we've talked about, that we begin with ourselves, and there we might realize that we do have some great old 19th century hospitals and institutions around that could be deployed in another way in our cities. And then if we remember the chief cause of disease, poverty, we might say, who gets the jobs? Who gets the businesses that supply them? That's just kind of a first step. You've still got the problem. But then beyond that, the sort of communal development that I think Mr. Altman was talking about. You asked, are the connections between third world and here? One of the main problems is that these people do not produce for themselves. They can go off and get a job somewhere. It doesn't affect how they live at all. Somehow, and it's our topic for tomorrow night, work needs to be re-established
recovered for community. But these are some of the things we might think to do, and I want to keep any other thoughts I might have, pretend to have, and ask you now to participate or to help with the seeing, the disturbing seeing, the judgment to be made out of our faith, or what is to be done, or what are you doing? Anybody? How about the women? No complaints? Women have been, they're a specialty. There's women's medicine. Favorite diseases are hysteria and anorexia, usually treated by male doctors, usually by drug and force feeding. In Boston, a women's collective published a manifesto saying our bodies are ourselves. That's just a hint. Any other? Yes, please.
I'm just thinking in your triangle up here, the when Walter was talking this morning, in the center of the triangle was,
yes,
was liberation theology. In other words, the seeing, judging, acting was a way to achieve that goal. I think the problem that we have with healthcare, I agree with you that poverty is a big cause of illness, maybe in other places, but I don't think it is in our country. I don't think there's enough poverty. I think the main problem, the main consumption of healthcare in our country is due to old age. Most of the healthcare dollars are spent on heart disease, stroke,
yeah,
cancer.
Let's notice the two things you said.
Right. So what we've got to decide here in our country is, what's our philosophy about healthcare? You got to have something at the center of it. You got to, right now what our country, what our society is telling medicine is, we want to live longer. That's the philosophy that's driving.
Well, now let's work our scheme on it. In fact, one-third of the medical dollars go for terminal care. Does that mean that's our biggest need?
I don't know, but if you, that's the demand. And I think that that's the monkey that's on the back of the medical system. I don't think they particularly want it. That's the problem. The public isn't caring about infant mortality.
Yes. This is part of what's happening in the hospital scheme. These aren't just a lot of blackguards that are doing it. The big hospitals need the big machinery and have to cover the costs. So they scoop up the small ones and even allow churches to do this and that by way of...
Bob, aren't those those ailments directly related to the choices that we make, the lifestyle choices that we're making?
Well, I think to some extent, but I mean, there's going to get to be a point in time that even if your lifestyle is just right, something's going to wear off.
You have to die of something.
If we get rid of cancer, heart disease, and stroke, as we talked about last week, we're starting to get Alzheimer's disease, brain degeneration disease, just general run down, I mean, we're going to wear out. And at some point in time, we're going to have to decide what our priorities are here. That's what's causing the consumption of healthcare dollars. It's not lifestyle. I mean, lifestyle is going to help you live a little longer, but you're still going to get to a point in time where your lifestyle isn't going to help you anymore.
Some countries, industrialized countries, have taken an approach which requires basic health tools for all, so far as public investment is concerned. And you can purchase your organ transplants if you're over 55. England, for example.
I think in our country, that decision is not going to be made by the public or by medicine. I think it's going to be made by the government and by insurance companies. That's where the crunch is going to come. They're going to be the people that are going to tell us where we're going to spend.
Califano, in his interesting book, having spent all that years at HEW, thought the government wasn't able really to take hold of this. And in the end, he's just hoping corporations might, because it's really bringing them out. The health costs of our products make them less than competitive. So exactly how to take hold of it is an important point at that level. And I don't think we've addressed that question here, certainly not very well. We have talked about putting some other things out there that look more like the future.
even there, though, basic tools shouldn't be out of our reach, you think?
No, but I think if you want to have health care back in the community and have these other measures besides going to the health care service providers first, then the public is going to have to accept the fact that the community and the neighbors and the druggist isn't going to be able to do coronary bypass surgery and isn't going to be able to do angioplasty or doing cancer chemotherapy, that they're going to have to accept living without that stuff. And that may be the best thing to do, but that's not...
Living without all that stuff?
Pardon me?
Living without all that stuff or without some of it? There was one footnote in the Illich paper, I don't know if this is really wrong, but he talks about previous cultures. That's how he always goes at it. Obviously, we are not a previous culture, but when you look, you know, it helps open your eyes in the present. But there was an institution in the Middle Ages of amicus mortis, friend of death. Everybody, middle-aged so-and-so, acquired a friend, an amicus mortis of this sort, a mortis. Of this sort, he couldn't be related to you. He couldn't be anyone who stood in any way to gain by your death. But it was his function, one day, the right day, to come and tap you on the shoulder and say, "Friend, this is it." Even without high tech, this was some kind of a problem. I mean, now is the time for you to think. Illich went so far as to say that certain kind of tumors might be rebuilt. Tumors. Friend.
Well, to see how many people want to come into their doctors and say, "I don't want the best, or you know, what's best for me and my immediate family. You know, I want second-class care." You know, people don't do that.
Second-class care?
Yeah. When they get sick, they don't.
Might we not be asking?
I don't want to have poor care.
No. I would like to pose our question: How do we arrange for the very best care? But I wouldn't. At one moment, I would like to not compare. I would not identify that to what everybody now chooses. But make that a conversation.
You have to define very best care.
Yes, that gets you mad.
And high tech care is a bottomless pit. And that's what Bob was talking about.
I think so.
And as we extend our median age, that becomes a bigger bottomless pit. We choose more labor and cost-intensive ways to spend dollars in healthcare. And we have somehow sold the American people on immortality through technology. And I think to the extent that there's been a spiritual void has been the extent to which people have glommed onto medicine and what we sell as a substitute immortality. And there's a tremendous spiritual void, I think, in many places. We have to define what is the very best care. I think that's correct. The technical answer to it is not an answer, in my opinion.
And all of our sources would say it can't be a complete answer because the subject is out of it, right?
Well, there's also a great focus on the individual. Remember when that little Jessica was in the well down in Texas and the whole country went bananas and spent, I don't know, I'm sure there was a number of millions of dollars to save little Jessica and everybody thought that was wonderful. Well, you could have taken millions of dollars and probably saved how many kids in poverty in this country? And it's just part of the human psyche. When it's an individual and you know who they are, or when it's you, that's what you want. You want the best. And how to change society's thinking about that is very difficult.
One thing that would come out of your very argument, though, is that the best care would come if those care about you get to do it. Wasn't that one of the things you were saying?
I'm sorry, I missed that. What was that?
We all went bananas for Jessica in the well, and you said, we really do go all out for those we care about. Shouldn't we put those who care about us to work on health? I guess I pointed to a kind of problem in which we have, overstating all, I'm saying stuff I don't believe, but I told you that. We have a situation in which health has become a kind of commodity. Don't we talk about healthcare delivery and healthcare deliverers? We really have kind of committed that problem to those who undertake to work on those labels. Right?
The healthcare delivery system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, otherwise, you really know the word.
It's kind of how the public, through the government, and where they put their resources, wanted to divide up this 10% of the gross national product, or how much do they want to put in, or maybe people want to put twice as much into it. It's up to them, and the individual physicians are trying to do the best they can for the patient who comes into their office with a problem to help them out. And that's the way the current system is. It may not be the most cost effective, but it's what at least the individual wants when they come in to see
you. Is it true? Let's do this at the level of a congregation. Do you or do you not find a problem in the congregation that your own member is taken to a hospital and is now out of, not only out of his own hands, but out of yours? And is that what the patient wants when he has to face these great problems and decisions?
That's a patient-physician family communication problem. And that can be improved. If they feel out ahead, then they can speak up and they can do something about it and they can communicate about it and try and improve the situation. I agree, you can feel a great sense of helplessness when you or your loved ones are there and you feel like you're being totally dominated. But there are recourses to that.
In the informed consent understandings we have with physicians, this actual situation, here we have people who do this every day, come on, sister, help her. Actual situation is one of people in great stress and even in pain, having to deal with information you can hardly process on the spot. A suggestion out of what we've been saying is that a surrounding community that has talked about that, thought about this before, is an important element in this situation. Not at present there.
It's great for people to have as much support and help as they can, but you can't take a poll of a congregation on a very personal matter about your personal health. I don't understand it.
I'm not sure a poll.
And if people have problems, if they don't trust their doctor, then they need to either get another doctor or get some second opinions and get some communication going about it.
But the decision may turn on an understanding of what life is all about, not just which technique does what.
Yeah, and if you feel, depending if the patient is aware enough, they can decide and have significant input into it, or whether they have earlier in their life, then you can use that in helping to make the decision to what extent do you go on prolonging life, or whether you're just prolonging death, and all of these kind of things. And it's an individualized thing that must be done, I think, between the patient and the physician or their immediate concerned family, and try to come to the best conclusion for that patient. And that's the way it's set up. It's not necessarily what's best for society as a whole, which would probably be to let them go and save the money and put the money elsewhere.
Well,
people
I would
want
like
to do that, they can do that. All they need to do is just quit paying for it. And saying at 65, no more bypasses, no more chemotherapy, no more the big stuff, no more kidney transplants.
Well, I
could save a lot of money by cutting those things off.
But yeah, I suppose there are economic considerations here. Of course there are, especially when money is not doing other things it could do. But I really meant to point to some other considerations. What a community believes about life can sustain this patient or this person in a crisis situation when an important decision is needed. Norman, do you have something?
No, that's what I'm saying. I think Matthew describes what's there, what isn't there. And your Dick say there ought to be something else as an option in that community, which we don't. I don't, not only we don't believe it, we don't understand it, and I don't think we even conceive what it would be like if the community of the congregation or something else were alive enough to make a difference in the way that person viewed death as well as life. I think that's what he's trying to pull us to. I think you described what's going on now, but I think he's saying there need or there is something else that we have covered up or denied or whatever else. Therefore, it is not part of health.
Maybe what Elmer just said and what we've heard here is what we should all take along and think about. I would like to just underscore a word that has emerged at the end of our conversation, namely death. I think we should all admit that's the trigger here. That is the problem, and I want to say two things about it. One, I was at a hospital not long ago when over the public address system came the words, visiting hours are over, please go quietly. I don't know how many congregations do that, or how many hospitals. The other thing I wanted to say is that we all know, in the language of faith, death and darkness are often together. And I did bring along another poem from Updike's Facing Nature. That's a pun, Facing Nature, in which he talks about darkness. You know, we've said tonight that physicians heal, medicine heals, congregations heal, faith heals, here's scabs heal, here's one, darkness heals. Listen, close your eyes, knowing that healing is a work of darkness, that darkness is a gown of healing, that the vessel of our tremulous venture is lifted by tides we do not control. Faith is health's requisite. We have this fact in view of better proof of Le Bon Dieu. Well, good night.